The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We've got quite a few things to get to on today's program. A number of clips as well, some audio clips coming up. We'll look into UN Ambassador Nikki Haley's bold defense of America's position on Jerusalem. We'll see what she had to say yesterday there in front of the Security Council. And also, speaking of speeches, strong speeches at that, President Trump had a pretty strong speech yesterday on his national security strategy. And suffice it to say, he sounds nothing like Barack Obama. Nothing like Obama, that's for sure. And you'll see that in some of the clips. But as we'll consider or ask, will this this flat-out rejection of the Obama doctrine, will it restore American greatness? We'll talk more about that coming up in the next segment. Just some, I guess, some Edstone news here before we kick things off. Richard Palmer just tweeted that his wife got her British citizenship. So, and as I understand it, I believe Brad McDonald is also looking into his citizenship. He was studying for the life—I forget what you call it—life in the UK. Test that he'll have to take. So some people here at Edstone putting down some roots, planting some roots. I'm coming up for my visa renewal in January as well. So it's hard to believe. 3 years almost. 3 years that I've been here. The McDonald family. 4 years? 5 years maybe? I forget the exact number of years. But Edstone, of course, has been up and running for over 3 years now, but January, the first week in January was when so many of us arrived back in 2015. Well, yesterday at the United Nations, the U.S. vetoed a resolution drafted by Egypt that pretty much condemned President Trump's decision a couple weeks ago to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And this was the first time in 6 years that the U.S. used its veto power in the council. The New York Times reported this morning, the one-page resolution drafted by Egypt reiterated the long-standing position of the Security Council, this is the Times, keep in mind, in several resolutions dating back 50 years, rejecting Israel's sovereignty claim over Jerusalem. So this is a long-standing, what the U.N. did is what it's always done. And, of course, the New York Times heartily supports it. It says, without identifying the United States by name, the resolution also reiterated the council's view that no country should establish an embassy in Jerusalem and that the city's status was an issue to be resolved by Israel and the Palestinians, who want East Jerusalem to be the capital of a future Palestinian state. And here's what the United States thought of that that resolution. This is clip 10.
The United States will not be told by any country where we can put our embassy.
A little bit of a different tone than what so many Americans have been used to in recent years. The U.S. is not going to be told by any country where we can or cannot put our embassy. The Telegraph. Here in the UK, it says the U.S. was left isolated and forced to use its veto at the UN on Monday after Britain and all other members of the Security Council voted for a resolution condemning Donald Trump's decision on Jerusalem. 14, it says, 14 out of the Council's 15 members supported the resolution, which called Mr. Trump's declaration null and void. How about that? The UN, this international body, it calls the declaration of Donald Trump null and void under international law. It's unlawful for him to take this course or to pursue this action. It says, although the resolution did not pass, that's because of the U.S. veto, the spectacle of Britain, France, and other U.S. allies voting against America illustrated how the U.S. position on Jerusalem is far outside the international consensus. I mean, that's even the Telegraph saying this. I mean, the United States is way outside the mainstream on this particular topic. And as I covered a couple of weeks ago, following Mr. Trump's declaration, I mean, never mind the truth, never mind the history, going back to 1948 or to 1967, or never mind even what the last four or five presidents have said. This is just outside the norm. And the United States is isolating itself. The United States is the bad actor here. The United States is the roadblock to peace. We've gone through some of the news stories recently, all the Arab nations that got together last week in Turkey that voted to basically say, we don't want the U.S. to lead in the peace negotiations. Mahmoud Abbas said as much as well. So you can look for Germany and Europe to take the lead in future negotiations between the Palestinian people and the Jewish state. Look at how much this is really singling out the U.S. I mean, these press outlets, they love pointing out, well, how isolated Israel is, and in this case too, the Trump administration. It says, Matthew Rycroft, this is from the Telegraph, the British ambassador to the UN told the council why Britain was voting against the U.S. We disagree with the U.S. decision unilaterally to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel before a final status agreement. We disagree, and so many other nations do. And all these other nations, of course, they choose what their capital city is and where they're going to put their embassies. But Israel is the exception. Israel doesn't have that right. Well, as I said, we went through some of that history previously. But speaking of some of the recent history, listen to Nikki Haley as she points out just how the United States has generously provided for the Palestinian people. This is clip 11.
The United States has done more than any other country to assist the Palestinian people, by far. Since 1994, we have given over $5 billion to the Palestinians in bilateral economic assistance, security assistance, and humanitarian assistance. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees operates schools and medical facilities throughout the region. It is funded almost entirely by voluntary contributions. Last year, the United States voluntarily funded almost 30% of UNRWA's budget. That's more than the next two largest donors combined. And it's vastly more than some of the members of this council that have considerable financial resources of their own. I'll be blunt. When the American people see a group of countries whose total contributions to the Palestinian people is less than 1% of UNRWA's budget, when they see these countries accuse the United States of being insufficiently committed to peace, the American people lose their patience.
That is some blunt language for sure from Nikki Haley. When Americans see all of these nations gang up on the United States, the one who's basically funding the Palestinian operation, funding the Palestinian people. I mean, since 1994, the U.S., not China, not Russia, not Britain, has given over 5 billion people to the Palestinians. $5 billion to the Palestinian people. It's pretty amazing. I mean, the U.S. is largely responsible for funding the budget of the U.N., and UNRWA, as she brought out there in that clip. That's just a little bit of the most recent truth And then you add to that over the years, since the peace process, this so-called peace process that has wounded, it's wounded Judah. It has wounded Israel. The many times the United States has twisted Israel's arm into making concessions and then funding the Palestinian people along the way. Sending one diplomat or envoy into the region after another. Here again, at the American taxpayers' expense. And the gall of these nations to get up and to denounce the United States because of where it's going to put its embassy really is. It really is stunning. This UN resolution, again, this was drafted by Egypt. Any decisions and actions which purport to have altered the character, status, or demographic composition of the holy city of Jerusalem have no legal effect, are null and void, and must be rescinded in compliance with relevant resolutions of the Security Council. President Trump, he has to rescind this. He comes out 2 weeks ago and states the obvious. Look, Jerusalem is what we all know it to be. It's the capital. It's where the Knesset is. It's where the prime minister lives. It's where all the government buildings are. It's where we have our consulate. We don't have the official embassy there because we're not supposed to. But all these officials, all of these government officials, it's where the president himself goes when he visits Israel to visit the prime minister. And so he comes out and states a demonstrable truth. An obvious fact. And you have even Great Britain denouncing him. Well, it was Russia, wasn't it, just a few months ago that came out and recognized Jerusalem. And even Russia voted for this. They were one of the 14. So who knows where they're coming from. But this really does single out the U.S., but I'm sure there's plenty of Americans that are right there cheering her on. One final clip from Nikki Haley's speech yesterday in the UN, clip 12.
What we witnessed here today in the Security Council is an insult. It won't be forgotten. It's one more example of the United Nations doing more harm than good in addressing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Today, for the simple act of deciding where to put our embassy, the United States was forced to defend its sovereignty. The record will reflect that we did so proudly. Today, for acknowledging a basic truth about the capital city of Israel, we are accused of harming peace. The record will reflect that we reject that outrageous claim.
What a difference. I mean, it was just a year ago when the Obama administration was leading the way in the UN to condemn Israel's right to East Jerusalem or the Temple Mount or any of those neighborhoods in the West Bank. They have no right to be there. That was just a year ago. And here we are a year later. Let the record show that I proudly raised my hand in protest against this insulting resolution. The record will reflect that. Well, when you look, though, at Bible prophecy, you don't want to get too worked up one way or the other. Although you have to, as you do with President Trump's speech from a couple weeks ago, you have to credit them for having a certain amount of courage to, in this case, stand up to a body that's obviously, obviously hostile. Hostile to Israel and the Trump administration and the United States in this case. But here is the U.S. acknowledging a basic truth. And the United States is made out to be the bad guy here. It's an outrageous, outrageous claim for sure. But the truth of it is, as we know, America's enemies, they're going to use this. They're going to use the Jerusalem question to gang up on the United States. The U.S. is going to be seen as the problem. You can see it in what played out yesterday at the U.N. When we come back, we'll look at another speech, this one given by President Trump in Washington, D.C. yesterday. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments, as always, to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Yesterday, the Trump administration released its first national security strategy. The Trump team had been working on this all year, the last 10 or 11 months. And finally, it was released, I think 47, 48 pages in PDF format. Victor Davis Hanson, he says this manifesto, as he calls it, is unlike most prior manifestos. It says the contrast with the 2015 Obama doctrine is stunning. It's a stunning contrast, to be sure. It says the disconnect emblematic in its unabashed preamble that the national security strategy puts America first. And of course, President Obama was working for 8 years to try to bring America down to the rest, level with all the rest. Certainly not first. Obama really emphasized the global institutions, as Hanson brings out in his piece. His worldview was influenced dramatically by radical leftist orthodoxy. But this one, President Trump's, to continue with Victor Davis Hanson, strength is defined as economic robustness, military wherewithal, strategic confidence, and spiritual renewal. And really, of those four, really, a lot of the focus here was on the economy, and that maybe is one of the more glaring flaws in what is, in a lot of ways, it's a pretty good speech. There were quite a few things that he said that, well, like I pointed out in the first segment, that I'm sure has many Americans cheering. Here are a few examples of that. This is clip one.
But to seize the opportunities of the future, we must first understand the failures of the past. For many years, our citizens watched as Washington politicians presided over one disappointment after another. To many of our leaders, so many, who forgot whose voices they were to respect and whose interests they were supposed to defend. Our leaders in Washington negotiated disastrous trade deals that brought massive profits to many foreign nations, but sent thousands of American factories and millions of American jobs to those other countries.
And so we've got to restore economic robustness, essentially. And this is a message, of course, that resonates with lots of Americans. I think the just pointing out, he did this a couple of times, actually, how other nations were enriched by trade with the United States, or how that we helped to fund, as you'll hear in the next segment or the next clip, we helped to fund a lot of the military support for the nations in Europe, for example, even when so many of those nations, as President Trump has rightly pointed out, are quite wealthy, Germany in particular. But coming back to this point, and these massive profits that foreign nations are bringing in, and what this will inevitably lead to, these positions, these kinds of declarations, as we've noted before, it's building to a trade war. And this is something that that we've been talking about, that the literature going back to the days of Herbert Armstrong prophesied about, based on numerous scriptures, Deuteronomy 28, Ezekiel 4 and 5. Notice what Mr. Armstrong wrote. This is from a 1971 article. He says, do not mistake, do not misunderstand me. I'm completely in favor of what is best in the interest of the American worker. But I want my readers to stop and think, he said, because our fellow American workmen are not working in their own best interests. Look at where the trends are leading, Mr. Armstrong wrote back in 1971. He said, look at where the trends are leading. It says when American workers are trying to get all they can get and at the same time giving as little as they can get away with, even to giving nothing. And then he talks about other workers overseas, how that it's in their national interest to work for half the wages of American workers because of their loyalty and patriotism for their country. Well, Mr. Armstrong says it means that we're headed one of two directions. And listen to this. Either we start raising high tariff barriers against other countries, starting a trade war, which in time will trigger the nuclear war that will destroy us, or, he says, or American workers are going to have to meet the competition of the workers in other countries by lowering living standards. He says, obviously, American workers are not going to choose to do the latter. And so for that reason, the handwriting is on our national wall, as he said. So, I mean, basically, in reading between the lines there from that 1971 Plain Truth, I mean, that's Mr. Armstrong basically predicting that someone like Donald Trump would come along with a message, with a campaign about high tariff barriers against other countries. Well, they're just taking in massive profits because we've negotiated disastrous trade deals. This, as you know, was a common theme out on the campaign stump last year. And here he is early on, President Trump, in his first national security strategy speech, talking about the return to economic robustness and fair trade, negotiating better trade deals so that we're not getting fleeced by nations abroad. He carries on in this speech talking about, again, what he didn't pull any punches when it came to his predecessors. Here he is yesterday in the same speech, clip two.
Our leaders engaged in nation building abroad while they failed to build up and replenish our nation at home. They undercut and shortchanged our men and women in uniform with inadequate resources, unstable funding, and unclear missions. They fail to insist that our often very wealthy allies pay their fair share for defense, putting a massive and unfair burden on the U.S. taxpayer and our great U.S. military.
Here again, he stresses the very wealthy allies and that they didn't pay their fair share for defense. And he's right. It's just like the U.N. budget. Here's the United States, $20 trillion in debt. And so many nations just living off the wealth, in this case, borrowed wealth, of the United States. The Palestinians do it. European nations do it. All of them do it. And who gets singled out at the UN? You guessed it. Mr. Armstrong again. This is from 1952. Yet in spending unprecedented billions of your dollars and mine, he says, tax dollars, preparing Germany and Europe for defense against the war that isn't going to come, he says, stupid, bungling America is spending its wealth and resources to produce the Frankenstein that's going to turn on us. You have now, thanks to America, very wealthy allies, quote unquote, in Europe and elsewhere. And they're turning on us. I mean, you can already see the turn. They're turning on us. Look at yesterday in the Security Council, 14-1, including Great Britain. 14-1. A resolution brought forward by Little Egypt condemning the U.S. action. Not Hamas, not Hezbollah, not Iran. The United States. I mean, if Israel takes the brunt of it at the UN, certainly the U.S. is not far behind. Not now, anyway. Not with this administration. As I say, I mean, it's a pretty different administration than the one that was just there in the UN a year ago, denouncing Israel. Carrying on, this is in that same speech yesterday.
They neglected a nuclear menace in North Korea, made a disastrous week an incomprehensibly bad deal with Iran, and allow terrorists such as ISIS to gain control of vast parts of territory all across the Middle East.
A lot of truth in that statement. I mean, these are problems that just sort of landed in President Trump's lap. The nuclear menace in North Korea. No U.S. president did anything about it. And then, as he says, this incomprehensibly bad deal with Iran. The ISIS movement. I mean, here's another big departure from the Obama doctrine. The fact that it's Iran, not Israel. It's Iran that's the greatest threat to peace in the Middle East. And to his credit, Donald Trump at least does a pretty good job in bits and pieces of this speech of clearly identifying the many problems. But will his administration be able to solve these many problems? That's the question. A lot of his supporters think that it will. Carrying on in yesterday's speech, here's clip 3.
And over the profound objections of the American people, our politicians left our borders wide open. Millions of immigrants entered illegally. Millions more were admitted into our country without the proper vetting needed to protect our security and our economy. Leaders in Washington imposed on the country an immigration policy that Americans never voted for, never asked for, and never approved. A policy where the wrong people are allowed into our country and the right people are rejected. American citizens, as usual, have been left to bear the cost and to pick up the tab.
Indeed. It was Washington imposed it on the country. And a lot of Americans, a lot of them, are upset. And they want to see a wall. And they want to see a crackdown on immigration, on illegal immigration. But as he's been finding out this past year, that's President Trump, whatever it is that he can accomplish, he's going to have to do it pretty much without the help of Congress, or certainly not the courts. But this is something, as he said, that Washington imposed on America going back as early as 1965. I mean, we're talking about two generations of just a steady stream of illegal immigration. And then when you think about what your Bible prophesies, even if there is a bit of a clampdown, it's too little, too late. I mean, Isaiah 1 and verse 7 talks about strangers devouring America. That's what's happening. And of course, God, through these prophecies, he's trying to get our attention. He's trying to get our people to wake up and to listen. Isaiah 1 and verse 7, as I say, Ezekiel 5 also talks a lot about the violence that's coming to our cities. We've gone through these prophecies before, and of course we have to give you the good together with the bad, and the fact that it all does lead up to, of course, the greatest good of all, which is finally, the establishment of God's kingdom on earth. Going back to the speech from yesterday, here's President Trump, clip 4.
On top of everything else, our leaders drifted from American principles. They lost sight of America's destiny, and they lost their belief in American greatness. As a result, our citizens lost something as well. The people lost confidence in their government and eventually even lost confidence in their future. But last year, all of that began to change. The American people rejected the failures of the past. You rediscovered your voice and reclaimed ownership of this nation and its destiny.
Sounds a lot like a speech Ronald Reagan would have given in the early 1980s, following the very negative and depressing time of the late 1970s, where a president, President Carter, talked about the malaise of the American people. And really, he's, of course, gotten all kinds of criticism for that speech. I forget when it was, in the late 70s. But so many conservatives denounced him. And, of course, Reagan, to his credit, came along and really he had a message of optimism and hope. And you see a lot of that now. But there was also a fair bit of what Jimmy Carter said in that speech that was true. When he talked about the sins of the people, he didn't put it in exactly those terms. I'll come to that here as we conclude this segment in just a bit. But there, we certainly have been drifting from American principles. There's no doubting that. And a lot of the blame does fall on the leaders. President Trump is right to point that out, but the Bible also points out that a lot of the blame falls on the people. The people. The sins of the people. Isaiah 59. I'll see if we have a little time later on to read a few verses from there. But let me just bring you to, I think, without question, the best part of the speech. I mean, this is not only a lot of truth, it's some good speech writing here from the president's advisors. Here's clip 5.
With this new confidence, we are also bringing back clarity to our thinking. We are reasserting these fundamental truths. A nation without borders is not a nation. A nation that does not protect prosperity at home cannot protect its interests abroad. A nation that is not prepared to win a war is a nation not capable of preventing a war. A nation that is not proud of its history cannot be confident in its future. And a nation that is not certain of its values cannot summon the will to defend them.
In other words, we need a strong nation. We need a strong nation to lead. As I say, that's some good writing there. And those are fundamental truths that so many in America used to believe in. We've got to be strong at home so that we can lead abroad. We've got to be confident in the future. We've got to defend our values. We don't want to apologize for those values. That, as I say, is probably the most effective part of the speech. Just a few more clips here before we conclude. Here's clip 6.
Our strategy advances 4 vital national interests. First, we must protect the American people, the homeland, and our great American way of life. This strategy recognizes that we cannot secure a nation if we do not secure our borders. So for the first time ever, American strategy now includes a serious plan to defend our homeland. It calls for the construction of a wall on our southern border, ending chain migration and the horrible visa and lottery programs, closing loopholes that undermine enforcement, and strongly supporting our Border Patrol agents, ICE officers, and Homeland Security personnel.
That right there is a big reason why he was elected last November. And there has been some crackdown on the illegal immigration, mostly from those agencies he mentioned there at the last, but he's not getting the support and help from Congress and from the courts, as I said. And furthermore, you think of the prophecies and what's been happening just on the ground since 1965. But you look at the prophecies in Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, about the tail rising up and becoming the head, or strangers devouring, Isaiah 1, Ezekiel 5. That's what we need to keep our minds locked into. God's prophetic word, the sure word of prophecy, whatever success he might have in defending the homeland in that way, it's going to be very limited for sure. Here's another one, another comment from yesterday, clip 7.
In addition, our strategy calls for us to confront, discredit and defeat radical Islamic terrorism and ideology, and to prevent it from spreading into the United States.
Here again, a big departure from the 2015 manifesto of Barack Obama, who, as Victor Davis Hanson said, tended to redefine existential dangers, not so much as hostile military powers, but rather as global natural threats, like global warming or AIDS or Ebola, and innate human prejudices. In other words, discrimination against groups like the LGBT community. Hansen says in the 2015 document, the words jihad or jihadism never appear. There's like 30 references to that in Trump's manifesto. Hansen says the 2015 Obama doctrine focused on climate change. In contrast, the Trump doctrine makes not a single mention of climate change. Instead, the document pledges U.S. leadership to counter an anti-growth energy agenda that is detrimental to U.S. economic and energy security interests. In other words, we're going to drill, baby, drill. What a departure. Quite a departure from his predecessor. Here he comes in with a renewed focus on, as Hansen brings out, on Islamist terrorism, which is certainly much stronger than anything Obama ever put out. But just going back to the very beginning of the so-called war against terrorism, as we said at thetrumpet.com, I mean, how successful can you be if you're fighting a war against an idea and there's no clear enemy? You can't get a fix on the head of the snake. It's the same problem. Look at what we've been covering of late about Iran's victory in Iraq. That's what it's been. Iran's victory in Iraq. Iran's victory together with Russia in Syria. The strength of Hezbollah. The strength of Iranian agents in Yemen. I mean, the influence of Iran is just spreading across the region. And here again, like I said yesterday, you have a lot of conservative commentators that are crying out that President Trump should get more credit for squashing ISIS. The thing is, and we have to keep making this point, America did it in alliance with Iran of all nations, the number one state sponsor of terrorism. This is hardly a victory. National Review had a piece just the other day about the decision time coming up on Iran. The president, that is, but this is going back to October, I think it was, when he wouldn't certify Iranian compliance with the JCPOA or the nuclear deal, which means he's going to have to make some pretty controversial decisions in the coming months. And I mean, judging by some of the strong language in that speech yesterday, maybe he's prepared to do it. He's going to have to go up against a lot, though. Resistance coming from the Democrats, also from European states. There's quite a few leftovers from the Obama administration that still work in government and that are going to do everything that they can to keep this JCPOA in place. But notice what this National Review piece said. This is from December 16th. It says, to date, President Trump's Iran policy has been mostly rhetorical, other than decertification. So that was what happened in October. Other than decertification and shooting down two Iranian drones over Syria, the United States, writes Middle East analyst Tony Badran, has relied on an indirect approach premised on avoiding direct confrontation with Iran and its instruments. And that's the truth. Where has the United States this past year directly confronted Iran and its instruments? I've mentioned over and again the speech that Tillerson, or just the comments that he made in Iraq just a few weeks ago, saying that ISIS is crushed and the Iranians can go home now. And the Iranians they're setting up homes, government buildings and the like, in Iraq. They're taking over all of these Iranian militias, General Soleimani. And Iraq would just as soon have them there. They're the real stability. They're the future. The United States, the truth is, the United States, while it may have confronted ISIS alongside of Iran, it has failed to confront Iran. And Iran is the head of the snake. And so you go back to that statement from yesterday, and good for him in calling out radical Islamic terrorism. I mean, the previous administration wouldn't even use the word Islamic. In fact, he went out of his way to say ISIS wasn't Islamic. So there is a different tone, no doubt about that. But really, we're going back to the same fundamental flaw. The premise, it's wrong from the get-go. It's identifying an idea, not an enemy. This article here, National Review, it says it's avoided going after Iran and its instruments, such as Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria, Shiite militias in Iraq and Houthi rebels in Yemen. But, this expert adds, this indirect long-term approach has proven futile and counterproductive. It says Iranian proxies have used the opportunity to consolidate their positions and expand their reach. Now, who can deny that? Just look at what Iran's doing together with all the proxies. They're consolidating their positions. They're entrenched in Iraq. I read that article yesterday about all of the opulence and the pictures of the Ayatollahs and so on. They're consolidating their positions and they're expanding their reach. Well, returning back to this speech from yesterday, one comment here again from Victor Davis Hanson. He says the theme of the Trump document is American restoration. In Reagan-esque fashion, the administration sees itself as similarly overturning an era of strategic stagnation, analogous to the self-doubt, self-imposed sense of decline, and thematic malaise of the Carter era. Instead, the strategic confidence and principled realism of the Trump administration will purportedly snap America back out of its Obama recessional in the same manner that Ronald Reagan did in the 1980s. Is that what's going to happen? Well, I don't think Victor Davis Hanson is necessarily suggesting that. He's just saying that's what the administration believes. America needs to be stronger. And if America is stronger, then the world order is stronger. If America weakens, so will the world order. A couple more clips from yesterday's speech. Here's clip number 8.
The third pillar of our strategy is to preserve peace through strength. We recognize that weakness is the surest path to conflict, and unrivaled power is the most certain means of defense. For this reason, our strategy breaks from the damaging defense sequester. We're going to get rid of that. It calls for a total modernization of our military and reversing previous decisions to shrink our armed forces, even as threats to national security grew. It calls for streamlining acquisition, eliminating bloated bureaucracy, and massively building up our military, which has the fundamental side benefit of creating millions and millions of jobs.
And so there we come back to the robust economic strength. But the strategy, as he said there at the start, peace through strength, that certainly is a better strategy than peace through appeasement. That doesn't work. That's been a failure, an abysmal failure. But as for building up the military, the total modernization of the military, removing the little defense sequester is not going to totally modernize the U.S. military. I think this is perhaps the best point that Victor Davis Hanson brings out in his piece. He says the doctrine unapologetically promises to restore both the quality and the quantity of American weaponry, conventional and nuclear, and to increase the numbers of U.S. military personnel. How such huge new military outlays will be possible in an age of tax cuts, infrastructure investments, and an existing $20 trillion in debt is not spelled out in detail, but apparently assumed in supply-side visions of radically increased economic growth. Hanson says, good luck with that calculus. Good luck with that. You're going to make all these massive infrastructure investments? You're going to slash taxes across the board? You're going to totally modernize the U.S. military? How is all of this paid for? It's a good question. Hansen says, much of the doctrine, this is Trump's doctrine, focuses on economic robustness. I read part of this earlier. Economic robustness, defined as restoration of American industrial growth, emanating from not just free but fair trade, rebuilding U.S. infrastructure, creating jobs, and barreling ahead with fossil fuel production. I mean, if you're an American, you do want all those things. But what have we said so often following the election of any president coming in making all of these promises? As an American, you hope for these kinds of positive developments. But the problems that we're facing, well, let me just conclude with one final clip. This is from President Trump's address yesterday on his national security strategy, clip 9.
With this strategy, we are calling for a great reawakening of America, a resurgence of confidence, and a rebirth of patriotism, prosperity, and pride. And we are returning to the wisdom of our founders. In America, the people govern, the people rule, and the people are sovereign. What we have built here in America is precious and unique. In all of history, never before has freedom reigned, the rule of law prevailed, and the people thrived as we have here for nearly 250 years. We must love and defend it. We must guard it with vigilance and spirit, and if necessary, like so many before us, with our very lives. And we declare that our will is renewed, our future is regained, and our dreams are restored.
So some good stuff all the way through in that speech. Some similar themes going back to what he said at the UN a few months ago, even going back to the inauguration or to the campaign from last year. I mean, he came in on the slogan, Make America Great Again. And here, as we conclude this segment, it's, I think, a good enough time as any to refer you to our booklet, Great Again, my father's book. From earlier this year, or maybe we printed it just at the end of last year. But he says early on in that book, my father does, he says, Mr. Trump does an admirable job of identifying these problems and addressing people's concerns. He does. He does do an admirable job of that. He did it in yesterday's speech. Addressing the concerns of the people. Identifying the problems that we're facing, so many of them. Make America Great Again. My father says that is a slogan that resonates with a lot of people who believe the United States has been mainly a positive force in the world. People who aren't embarrassed about the nation's history and unique identity. It says anyone who sincerely admires this country wants to see America made great again. Anyone, any American, truly does want to see America made great again. But my father says, if you understand the spiritual dimension of why America is no longer great, as it once was, then you know why no politician is going to be able to turn things around. If you look at the last bit of that statement that I played for you, guarding this America, what this American way, returning to the wisdom of the founders, a great awakening, a resurgence of confidence. He wants that. So many of his supporters do. Any American, as my father said in that booklet, who admires the country wants to see greatness again. But where did America's greatness come from to begin with? How did America come upon all of this fabulous wealth and prosperity and power? Well, another book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, answers those questions and also shows why those many blessings are being taken away. As my father said in Great Again, conditions in America may improve for a short time. I think you could say that that has happened in these last 10 or 11 months. Certainly when you look at the economy, the stock market, those kinds of things, jobs. Conditions in America may improve for a short time. It may even help the work of God. But its ultimate end is destruction. Our people are going to face the wrath of God until they repent. And then he references Amos 7 and verses 7 through 17. But there is hope, and that's even brought out in that same prophecy, Amos 7. All of this does culminate in Christ's return to this earth. Well, that is all that we have time for on today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.